Good morning, diners, eaters, drinkers, people who like to gossip about culinary things, travelers.
You know what? The funny thing, it might not even be good morning when these people are listening. You can never tell, can you?
Never tell, no.
What time of day it might be, so whatever.
The internet has changed the world.
So we'll say good day, assuming that you're...
Good day.
Assuming that you're listening on a day.
I'll make a point of that.
Yes, there we go. That's the correct things.
If you want to do any of those things, you're at the right place because you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Here we are, as usual.
Yeah, and we're going to start off today with a public service announcement.
Yeah, but it's okay. it's also a party invitation, so it fills two requirements for fun. But for those of you who are not from the greater Pittsburgh area and therefore are not interested, it's an interesting chat anyway, and come back and be sure to come back in at least 5 minutes.
Well, the cause
we'll get on with the rest of the program.
It's not local, the Pancreas Foundation.
But the event's local.
Right.
And we caught up with someone who's running a big party on September 1st on the south side in Pittsburgh. Here's Christine Dickerson.
Well, we have an old buddy on our show today, Christina Dickerson of Dickerson Creative. And the reason we've gotten to be friendly is that she does a wonderful event every year, which is called Savor Pittsburgh, right?
That's right. Hi,
welcome,
Ann. How are you, Christina?
Great.
Thank you so much.
A lot of different events feature local chefs and cooking contests, very hot subject these days. But yours is on a grander scale. Could you just describe your event?
Well, thank you. It is. We take so much pride in this event and absolutely love Savor Pittsburgh. Basically, what we created about 6 years ago was a culinary competition among some of Pittsburgh's best chefs. And every year the restaurants change. We always have some consistent restaurants participating. But basically, we do a culinary competition. This year we have 25 restaurants participating, which is very exciting. And it's great. And all of the restaurants are competing for either best appetizer, best entree, best dessert, people's choice, and of course the most prestigious is dish of the year. So we're thrilled because these chefs bring all of their culinary talents. They bring their A game. I say that all the time.
They bring their A game
to this event and really want to impress the judges and the people who are attending the event. So we are proud to bring that to Pittsburgh every year. The event was created by McCormick & Schmick Seafood Restaurant, Southside Works, and I'm proud to be a part of the event. It's fantastic.
Well, one of our friends said that he goes to a lot of these, and it's the first one he's ever been to where all the different booths didn't run out of food. He's a big eater.
Yeah, well, and that's true. That's really something from a restaurant perspective. With 1,500 guests in attendance, that's a huge amount of dedication that these restaurants and their chefs and their sous chefs are putting into this event. So we are always so immensely grateful for their dedication and their devotion to Savor Pittsburgh.
And now, while McCormick & Schmick does the sponsorship of it, every year benefits a particular charity.
Correct.
And this year, I think, is a very relevant one.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. This year, we are proud to say that we have partnered with the National Pancreas Foundation. This is an organization who has recently formed a chapter here in Western PA, and they are making a tremendous difference already in increasing the number of programs to target, pancreatic disease, pain management, nutrition, healthy lifestyles. So we want to help them make a difference. Our title sponsor is Mosaic Consulting, and unfortunately, one of the gentlemen who serves on our committee for Savor Pittsburgh, he recently lost his mom to pancreatic cancer in March, and we just felt like this was the most appropriate charity choice for 2011 to obviously, recognize his mom and hopefully, like I said, help the National Pancreas Foundation raise a lot of money and a lot of awareness for diseases and cancers that affect the pancreas.
Now, there are 25 restaurants
participating. There are also stations serving beer and wine, correct?
Yes, and we have the Kettle One Ice Luge,
oh,
which everyone loves every year with the different martinis and drinks. So we've got great wines. We've got lots of cocktails for people to enjoy responsibly. And just come out. It takes place September 1st. At 6:30 p.m. is when the event takes place. You can get tickets online at SaverPittsburgh.com and come out, enjoy an evening under white canopy tents, dance to No Bad Juju, and again, all the proceeds benefit the National Pancreas Foundation.
And guess who's helping with the judging of the dishes?
And I love it. I love that you guys, that you come every year.
Well, I think I got pressed into service last year, and I guess I must have done a really lousy job, so I get to do it again this year.
Yeah.
Well, you get dessert. The first, Christina, the first year I did it, I think we had to taste 42 dishes.
But seriously, folks, this is a fine party in the fine tradition of Southside partying.
Yes,
and
it's
something
really
you shouldn't miss. If you want further details, I'm going to be putting a news item up on the OTM news page on our website as soon as I get those details from Christina. But in the meantime, if you Google Savor Pittsburgh, that's SAVOR Pittsburgh, I'm sure you'll get to the place where you can get tickets, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
I look forward to seeing both of you on September 1st.
And Christina, you're doing a great job. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You have a wonderful day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, listeners, we're going to have a short break, and then we'll get on with the rest of the program. So stick with us, please.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I learned a lot from our next guest, actually.
And so will you, I think.
Yes.
I mean, he's a real expert.
He is an expert, and the product is fab. So I didn't know, actually, that the tequila could taste that good and so smooth, but he's sitting on a good product, and he knows what he's doing.
So...
We're listening to Jacques.
Jacques is his first name, and you can try his last name if you like.
Ves Videnhout.
Well done.
I'm going to introduce our guest in this interview by saying his first name is Jacques, and I can't pronounce his last name. Go ahead, Jacques.
Ves Videnhout.
And Videnhout, we discovered. He's a Dutch-South African name, and somehow or other Jacques, nevertheless, finished up in San Francisco working for an American company which makes tequila in Mexico. Go figure that one out. and not only that, the making of tequila has been going on for centuries, but this company's been in business for how many years now?
Just around about 7.
It's really amazing. You wouldn't think that someone would want to take on entering the tequila business. So I'm going to ask you to explain why, although I'm guessing that I know the answer.
Well, for me, it was a natural progression. You know, when I moved to San Francisco, I kind of rediscovered tequila because I grew up with drinking bad tequila in South Africa, so I took a 7 or 8 year break from it. But when I moved to the States, through a close friend of mine here in San Francisco, discovered how really good tequila can be. And then, you know, over the course of a number of years, taking trips to Mexico and going visiting the distilleries and learning more and more about 100% agave tequilas.
And the name Partida is actually a Mexican family name.
Exactly, the Partida family. So I was asked to be the opening bar manager for a tequila bar here in San Francisco called Trace Agaves. And through the course of opening up Trace Agaves, one of our regular customers was Gary Shansby, the owner of Partida. And we became friends, and he offered me this great job to work with Partida. And I very quickly jumped at it.
Now, Gary was a successful American businessman in the food business. Shackley Corporation, didn't they make a lot of line of supplements and things like that?
Yeah, exactly.
So he was in their business, but he was a Mexicophile, or however you pronounce that.
He's got a beautiful home in Mexico, and he's always loved the country.
Now let's just give our listeners a couple of landmarks here before we go in to talk about why you win these kinds of awards and why Partida is a name for tequila lovers, in fact, spirits lovers in general, that they should know about and they should enjoy, because there are a number of ways of measuring whether anything's any good. But if Paul Packelt's Spirits Journal gives 5 stars to every one of your 4 products, and Wine Enthusiast rates you as Classic, which is the highest possible award for all 4 of your levels of tequila, and no one else in the ranking of the top 30 tequilas gets more than 2 in that ranking, something's obviously going on here. You're doing something special, something right.
Exactly. That's what we like to think.
So give us some of the parameters, some of the things that Partida is doing, shall we say, better than anyone else, if not other people aren't really doing this at all.
No, there are other really good tequila companies as well that are, you know, I think it's the fact that from beginning to end we keep an eye on everything that we do. In the process of making tequila, you have how you grow your agaves, how long you grow your agaves, how you harvest them, and when you bring them back to the distillery, how do you cook those agaves and for how long, and then obviously how you distill and then how you age. So there's a lot of steps in between where points of quality that you can hit, or you may not be interested in hitting those, and that's what makes a difference between good tequila producers and average tequila producers. From the beginning, we grow our agaves from anywhere from 7 to 10 years, making sure that the humidors in the fields are always looking for ripe or mature agaves to harvest. So we're not cutting corners by harvesting that agave when it's not ready to go yet.
Now, you grow all your own agave?
Yes.
Now, is that typical?
Take one.
Is that typical of tequila producers?
Not at all. There's a handful of people that can say that. So obviously there's a lot of agaves being grown in Mexico right now, and I can go buy agaves from somebody off the market if I wanted to. So, yeah, we're a state-grown, so, you know, from beginning to end, we...
control it, yeah.
We control it, which...
How do you know when it's mature? It's a cactus.
Well, actually, it's not a cactus. It's in its own plant variety. There's something like over 350 different types of agaves.
Really?
Obviously, for tequila, we're using the blue agave. But it's more of a succulent in the same species or family as the lily plant. So,
oh, my.
Yeah, so it's got nothing to do with the cactus, really.
Oh.
But the humidors, or the guys in the fields, the people that harvest the agaves, they have these long kind of wooden poles, and at the end of them they have a round blade. It's called a koa, and that's how they chop up the agave to get ready to take to the distillery. So they, obviously from years and years of experience, they know what signs to look for when this agave is ready. The way that the penca leaves kind of condense at the top in the middle, there's sometimes you see signs of natural kind of fermentation going on. It's kind of red blots on the plant.
Really?
So they know what to look for, and then they obviously, if the plant's ready to go, they harvest it.
Now, is mezcal made from agave?
So tequila is made from one agave plant.
Okay.
The blue variety, the Weber blue variety. With mezcal, you can use up to 28 different agave plants.
It's at the Fancy Food Show in D.C. Last month, there were so many mezcal dealers, and that is rough, rough stuff.
Well, there's some good mezcals in the market now. The people from Del Maguey are doing a great job. There is a lot of rubbish, but I think there's a few small producers now that are, you know, the
really?
100% agave mezcals, some really interesting agaves.
What makes a consumer prefer tequila over mezcal, or vice versa?
It's a good question. I mean, I think mezcal is a little bit, I don't want to say, because I love good mezcals. I think you've got to be a little bit more attuned to it, or a bit more ready for that kind of agave-forward, slightly smoky agave distillate. Whereas tequila, I think also, we've kind of all grown up drinking tequila one way or another in our lives, so I think we've all just become more accustomed to tequila. And then they also have the different aging styles, so reposado and añejo. So if you're a whiskey or cognac fan, you can use tequila, añejo tequilas as kind of an entry point into the category.
No, it's the añejo and the extra añejo. To me, they should be consumed like sipping whiskey, which is probably not surprising, since the extra añejo is actually aged in Jack Daniel's barrels.
Right.
So you're doing the right thing there. You're making the right connection there. But there are these different levels. Perhaps you can explain so our listeners who are new to tequila will know the difference between a Bianco and Reposado and an Añejo and why.
Right. So typically all tequila starts as a Blanco or silver tequila. So meaning unaged, it's coming off the still, and you're then just bringing it down to bottle strength by adding distilled water to bring it to 80 proof or whatever your distillery strength is. So unaged tequilas, they don't see the inside of the barrel at all. So you can, by law, age it if you want for up to 2 months, but generally they're unaged.
Then they're totally clear.
Yes. There are two brands that age for, one's for 28 days, one's for 40 days, but you see a slight kind of a strawy yellow color, but for the most part, it's not really common. Then the second category in tequila is called reposado, or rested, and this means your tequila can either be aged from 2 months to less than a year in any kind of oak container or of any size. Most people are use whiskey barrels from either Kentucky or Tennessee. The third category is añejo, or aged tequilas. Here you age for a minimum of 1 year to no more than 3 years, and in barrels no larger than 600 liters. And again, for the most part, people are used American whiskey barrels. But people, you know, Mexico is starting to experiment a little bit more now, so you're starting to see some French barrels, some used cognac barrels, sometimes Spanish barrels, so it's getting really interesting. And then the newest category that came up a few years ago is the extra añejo category. So you age your tequila for a minimum of 3 years, and then as long as you want after that.
Well, that's
okay,
the one
so
I
that's
like.
So yeah, that's the difference. In fact, that's the one you sent, of which you sent as the largest quantity to sample, which seemed like a very nice idea.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
and we really have been enjoying it. Anne's been checking the level on the bottle frequently. And,
good.
Yeah. How much does this sell for? Because, I mean, I think we're going to have to go buy some.
The extra añejo, the elegante?
Yes.
Anywhere from $300 and up.
Bottle.
Yeah.
I guess we won't be buying And you keep away from that bottle.
The regular añejo?
That is, I've seen anywhere from $55 to $60 and up.
Okay, and then the Reposado and the Bianco, respectively, are...
Yeah, so the Reposado will be around about $45 mark, and then the Blanco, $30 and up.
Okay, so this is a very similar price point to Don Julio, which is, a top brand from a style standpoint, if nothing else, that the people who are tequila fanciers probably know, right?
Right, yes, similar price point, for sure.
I remember when I was in Mexico, 2000, I guess, 11 years ago, I was there 6 or 7 times in a 3-month period, and all the people there that I talked to said Herradura was their feeling as to what the top brand should be. And listeners, if you remember, we talked before about Partida getting 4 classic ratings. Herradura got 2 superbs and 2 classics. So that's pretty good, too. But I used to drink my tequila with sangrita on the side.
I love sangrita.
And there's no way that I would do that with añejo Partida.
No, I think sangrita is better suited to either Blanco or Reposado tequilas.
Yeah, I couldn't even find a recipe for sangrita, and I have all kinds of Mexican cookbooks. I don't know why I couldn't find one.
Send me an email, I'll send you my recipe.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, why don't you just send us another bottle of it? We don't need the sangrita. I can't believe it, $300. I mean, you were talking money there.
Well, that's the extra añejo.
Yeah, we don't make a lot of that.
No, you don't make a lot. I mean, that's like that 5-star Martell that we bought in Australia, that we bought so we could get the beach bag that came along with it. and we finished that off. So it's
I guess your big challenge is marketing, really, because I think tequila is becoming more popular in the States, but people are not very, very astute about it, and there are certain names that just, what is the Padron or what's the name of that tequila? Everybody knows the one where you get silver. Or
well, Don Julio is probably the one that has the best market presence, wouldn't you say, aside from Partida? Wouldn't you say that, Jack?
The leader in the premium tequila category right now, in terms of sales by volume, is Patron.
All I know is that, I mean, everybody you talk to, that's the name of the brand that they mention, and I don't know anything further than that, except I would say that getting the word out for Partita is the most crucial thing at this point.
Well, that, I'm sure that's been happening, right? I mean, Gary Shansby, the owner, is a marketer, if nothing else. So he's certainly been trying to figure out how to enter a market that's already heavily populated with something that's new.
Right. And we've been hitting it hard, you know, just I think it's not only just marketing, but it's also what I'm doing and a lot of the sales team are doing. We're out in the market talking to consumers and people that run bars and restaurants and conveying the message that tequila is a quality spirit up there with single malt scotch and cognacs and armagnacs and the rest. For the longest time, it has and still has this perception that it's this crazy frat party shot that visit as a teenager and then you never really return to. But the more we show consumers that, you know, you don't need to serve a quality tequila like Partita in a shot glass. We you know, there's special readout tequila glasses now that on the stem, and it's about
we have tequila
it's about
glasses.
Savoring.
Do we have tequila
yes,
glasses?
Yes, we do.
Because we have grappa glasses too. We have all kinds
but
of glasses.
We have they're unusual looking tequila glasses.
But let's take a couple of distinctions here, because I think tequila is, among other things, a cocktail mix. I'm guessing that aside from shot glasses at frat parties, the most common use of tequila is together with triple sec in making margarita. And that's where most people have met it. Now, if you get out of that mode, and suppose you're drinking a reposado or an añejo, and you want to experience what it really tastes like, how do you suggest to be served? And let me explain a little bit further what I mean. I've been told by Scotsmen themselves that a Scot will never appreciate fine Scotch whiskey because they're all too mean. It costs so much they automatically required to water it down.
Right.
So they never get the true taste. And an American will never get the true taste because they insist on putting ice in it.
Right.
So how do you suggest that people sample tequila best?
Well, there's two ways. From a professional standpoint, I think any spirit is best evaluated in a stemmed tulip-style glass, like a proper spirits glass.
And it's served at room temperature without ice?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And the same goes for any of our tequilas. So in a restaurant, when I do a tasting, if they don't have those glasses, I'll generally taste the people on with either wine glasses or champagne flutes, so you can really get the aromas coming through in the glass. Now, if not one to be sitting at a bar and drinking tequila out of a champagne flute or wine glass, just a good tumbler glass or an old-fashioned glass is good. But like I said, we're just trying to get away from this idea that tequila has one glass and it's a two-ounce shot glass for throwing the stuff back. So it should be savored like any other great spirit in the world. And so, yeah, if I'm tasting properly, then I'll use a stemmed spirits glass to really evaluate the spirit.
But you won't keep it chilled. I mean, a lot of people, including a lot of Italians themselves, keep the grappa in the icebox, in the freezer, and
yep.
A lot of people keep vodka the same way we do in this house. But room temperature is where you're going to get the best flavor.
Yeah, I think so. I think in any spirit, but I mean, you know, then it also comes down to how you personally enjoy it. If you like your Blanco tequila sitting in your freezer at home, who am I to tell you that you are wrong? That goes for everybody. I'm just saying that if you're going to, for the first time, taste any tequila or any spirit out there, you know, it's best done at room temperature in a proper glass.
Well, Jacques, I think on the menu, as ourselves, we have appreciated your introducing us to a fine new brand.
Which we can't afford.
Which you can't afford, but it's okay. And I think listeners out there, if you haven't tried this,
it's fabulous.
You really deserve to give yourself a treat and add to the arsenal of things that you like either before or after dinner. And my own recommendation, because I'm consuming the faster than Annie's, I'm using it when I'd be using sipping whiskey after dinner, because it just seems to do such a wonderful job of that. And we thank you for all your work, and we wish you great success with the continued success like this with the brand.
And nice meeting you, Jacques.
You too. Thank you for your time.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Oh,
Okay, we're back again with a fascinating guest coming up next.
But I wanted to remind
you. Oh, you did.
That's when you email.
Oh, Jacques, okay.
Make sure you ask for that sangria recipe. He's very.
Oh, okay. Are we going to ask everybody on the program if they want to do that too?
Sure.
So if you have a good
email us if you want
if you
a
have
good,
good
sangria recipe,
or if you have one, be sure to send it to us because we're looking for one. But we did ask our last guest for one, and if you want ours that we get from him, we'll be happy to send it to you. And if not, if you have one you'd like to contribute, that would be fine too. Now, back to the
next stop.
Back to the program.
Very interesting guy. I just wonder how many talented, successful musicians and conductors and so forth get involved with food, but they do.
Yeah, and how you go on to build a cookie empire or are the cookies? They're not really cookies. They're crisp breads. What are they really called?
It's like a thin cookie, but it's sort of on the.
He said they were kind of a little bit like biscotti. Anyway, Almondina is the name of the product. When you hear about it, you're going to love it. If you don't have time to listen to the track, you can be sure you're going to love it. So go out and buy some right now. And here's Yuval. Boy, we got tough names today, huh?
Yeah, we have a lot of tough names.
I'm not going to ask you to pronounce his last name. We're just going to talk about Almondina.
Well, we have a fascinating guest on this interview segment, Yuval Zaliuk, is it? Yuval?
Yep, you said it right.
I said it right. Okay. Yep.
Hello, Anne. Hello, Peter. I'm really
welcome
delighted.
On the menu, yes. And the reason you're here is because I fell in love with a cookie. Or a whole bunch of cookies. But let's start about how complicated. You are primarily a musician, an American-Israeli musician and symphony conductor. You play three instruments, piano, percussion, and what else?
Trombone.
Trombone, which we could not forget. So how did you end up making Almondina cookies?
The Almondina cookies are a creation of my grandmother. About 80 years ago, she was a fantastic cook, maybe the best cook I've ever met. And she was very famous in Haifa, Israel, with her cooking, but also with what she called petit gâteau sec, which means little dried cookies.
You know, why French for that?
Because she studied cooking in France.
I see. So she was a trained
cook. She's a cordon bleu. Yes, absolutely. And she took the conventional Mandelbrot, or
okay,
if you wish in Italy, biscotti, and turned it into a masterpiece. It's not a Mandelbrot anymore. It's not a biscotti.
Right.
It is Almondina, by itself.
Yeah, it's much thinner than biscotti because I tried dipping it in my coffee, like you do biscotti, and it doesn't like that very much.
Now, I got the... She kept it secret. She only shared the recipe with her daughters. One was my mother and my aunt. And she kept the secret almost to the end of her life, and then I managed to somehow get it out of her.
So she had told your sisters, but she wouldn't tell you.
His mother.
It was supposed to stay with the women of the family, not the men.
I see. Okay, yes. Well, I can understand that.
Yeah. And anyways, her name was Dina, and since it's an almond cookie, I named it Almondina in her honor.
I'll be darned.
But that's it's a stretch from getting the recipe to having how many different products in your product line and having them distributed all across the United States?
Yes, it is. It is a big stretch. It's actually, I have a cute story. My mother, who died a year and a half ago, few months shy of 100.
Okay.
She lived in Israel, in Haifa, and we exported the cookies to Haifa, so she could go down from here, from Toledo. So she could go down to a store in her neighborhood and buy her mother's cookies via Maumee, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
No kidding. So that's where Almondina cookies are made. Is that where you live too, or is that just where they're made?
I came to the United States in 1980 to be the music director and conductor of the Toledo Symphony, and Maumee is a suburb of Toledo.
Right, I knew that. So, isn't that absolutely amazing?
When did you... Okay, you got the recipe. When?
Oh, in her life. Okay. That was years ago. That was in the 60s.
Okay.
And I kept it. And I grew all my life with these cookies in her jar. And not only I did, but every guest that she ever had the first thing they entered their house was, where are the cookies?
Uh-huh.
So it was already then people got addicted to it. And I knew all the time that maybe one day I'm going to commercialize them somehow.
And so when did that happen?
And that happened in 1989, that's 22 years ago, towards the end of my tenure with the Toledo Symphony. I said, well, if I'm not going to do it now, I will never do it. And as a true American story, I suddenly flew off.
It took off unexpectedly.
It grew.
It took off.
It took off. No, it flew off. It
flew off, really?
I mean, it literally went up the sky.
Well, now what happened to you? You were in Toledo. Are you still in Toledo?
I'm still in Toledo. I'm in Maumee, actually, this very minute. That's where the bakery is. Are you
still conducting, or you're not conducting?
I am on a kind of self-imposed sabbatical, but I hope, of course, to come back to it one day. But it's at the moment, everything is dedicated to this incredible cookie.
Well, they are wonderful. You have to understand that they arrived amidst absolutely a slew of cookies, because it's right at the time of the Fancy Food Show in Washington, D.C., and everyone sent samples to us. So, and first of all, I don't even have a sweet tooth. So when they arrived, I thought, uh-oh, more cookies, until I opened and tasted them. And they stood out from these other cookies like diamonds glowing.
But 80% of our sales are the original cookie, which is the Grandma Dina original recipe.
Yes.
I then went on and developed some 10 more flavors myself. Peter, I'm like you, I'm a cook.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
Not only that, we have a lot in common. I'm a big traveler like you.
Okay, good.
And
good.
I lived 15 years in London, where I met my wife. I was conductor of the Royal Ballet, Covent Garden, and she was a member of the Royal Ballet, a ballerina.
Oh, really?
Amazing, yes. Absolutely amazing.
I conducted Fontaine and Rev for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
At the Covent Garden. And that's where I met Susan.
And she's English?
She's Canadian, the first Canadian to go to London to be a member of the Royal Ballet Company.
Amazing. Wow. Well, that's a fine company and a fine orchestra, too.
Oh, incredible. Yes.
But this was it. What part of your life was this? I mean, what decade and a half was this that you were there?
65 to 70.
Okay, well, we were there at the same time, but not for very long.
But if you went to a Royal Ballet performance, you may have seen me conducting.
I probably didn't. I lived in London, found it to be way too busy and way too expensive, and I moved to Australia, and I don't know what your excuse was, but you left after 15 years too, so you must have reached the same conclusion, I think.
In 1973, I had a whole Australian tour, so I know Australia too.
Yeah. Great. The funniest thing, you would know the Covent Garden area very well in London, I guess, since you worked there.
I was there a few weeks ago.
But you were there for a long time also. But
yes.
I don't know how familiar you are with London as a whole, but there's a wonderful market south of the Thames called the Borough Market.
Yes, of course I'm familiar with it.
Well, I don't know if you saw this, but about 5 years ago, they acquired the cast iron front of what was to be a market entrance in Covent Garden, which was never erected.
Ah.
And they bought it and put it up as the facade of the Borough Market.
No kidding. This I did not know. Yeah. Thank you for telling me. Next time I'm there, I will take a good look.
Next time you go, and there's a wonderful restaurant on the on what they call the flower market level of the Borough Market, which is actually just the second level. There's a wonderful restaurant there called Roast, which occupies the second floor of this wonderful facade and gives you beautiful views across the market. It's a really extraordinary improvement, considering the fact that about 10 years ago they were worried it would close.
Absolutely. The whole area there is now so, you know, with the Tate's Modern and the whole walk along the river is just absolutely breathtaking.
They used to have an egg vendor who sang opera very poorly, I might add.
No, I'm actually writing an itinerary along the Thames, along the Jubilee Greenway.
Yeah.
For a website. If I can ever get it finished.
Yeah.
So I've just...
because of the Olympics. You know.
Well, and it's actually for a website called Unanchor, which I discovered on the internet. So I'm writing about all these places along the walk that I know. I just realized that route of flight would take you past the Oxo Tower.
Yes.
So I realized I have to include that. I did find out something fascinating. This is just worth including before we finalize. Apparently the people who bought the Oxo Tower, the company's actually not called Oxo, it's actually called something else, but Oxo was their product, and they wanted to get permission, put a sign on the building. And the local government in London said they couldn't do that. So during the reconstruction of the building, they very carefully spelled out OXO in tiles as part of the Art Deco frontage that they put on the building.
Yeah.
So it's not actually a sign, it's windows.
Yeah.
But I thought that was pretty... Anyway, back to
the cookies.
Back to Amandine's cookies.
You have how many flavors now?
So we have about 10 flavors now.
And how do they differ? I mean, I like the originals. I like the almond.
The original is, as I said, 80% of our sales. It's the one that you can describe as more generic. I always tell people, start with the original, get addicted, and then you can sample the other one.
And what are some of the other
ones? Well, we have ginger spice, which is it's good for English people. They like
ginger. Yeah, they have ginger, right.
Cinnamon. We call it Cinnaroma, which is, of course, I think America's most favorite spice. And we have chocolate called Choconut, and we have chocolate cherry.
I've had that one, yes.
Yeah, and we have sesame, which is my favorite.
And I'll have to look
loaded,
for that one.
Loaded with sesame. And we have anise called Anniversary.
Oh, that's cute. We must mention that you call it the healthy cookie.
Yes,
too.
We call it the delicious cookie without the guilt.
Right, that's it.
And the reason it is without the guilt is that it's not only delicious, which, you know, most of the products that have no guilt, like no cholesterol, no salt.
They have no taste.
they are not addictive, if to use a very understatement.
No, they all taste like cardboard.
Yeah, you said it, Anne.
I know.
I can't. It's my competition.
Of course you can't.
But Amandine is not only incredibly addictive once you start eating it. It's very difficult to stop. But it doesn't have added fat. It does not have salt.
You don't feel heavy. You eat them and you don't feel guilty because they seem to be
that's why it is
light and healthy.
You know what the best news is? You can buy them just about everywhere.
I'll tell you in a minute where you can get them, but primarily for those people who cannot find it in the stores, it's in almondina.com. They can get it online.
Well, I took a look there and saw the store locator. There are certainly plenty of places who realize that Amandine is great stuff.
In your area, Pittsburgh, you have in Giant Eagle, you have Trader Joe's, you have TJ Maxx, you have Marshall's, that's the national chains. Ruggeri, you call it Ruggeri or Ruggeri?
Ruggeri.
Ruggeri's is about a mile from our house, but Whole Foods is only about 500 yards away.
Uh-huh. La Briola.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah. Okay.
Shady Side Market, Coons, Engels Market.
Yeah, Shady Side Market's called the Tiffany of fruit.
Everywhere in the country is Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. If you find them in Trader Joe's, you're lucky because
they sell out.
But Trader Joe's sells only the original and have been for 8 or maybe 10 years.
I think you can even buy them on Amazon.com, can't you?
Yes, but I would buy it in Almondina.com because they're fresh.
But you know,
the other thing with Amandine is that it's a very versatile. It's a gourmet almond cookie, 30% almonds, by the way. It's a cracker. You can.
Okay,
really
I wanted you to mention that's great with soft cheese.
Unbelievable with brie, tripe, or San Andre.
Yes.
It's to die for.
Right.
And then it's a snack. It's literally a snack. It's just like potato chips.
Now, let me ask you this. Your grandmother did not make these commercially. Now, what changes to the recipe did you have to make in order to be able to produce these commercially?
And no change.
Really?
She was 80 years ahead of her time with no cholesterol, no added fat, no salt, you know, all these things. That absolutely no change.
Wow.
It's quite amazing. So, yeah, she was something else.
I'm really delighted to have found the cookie and also to find you and to befriend you.
I'm delighted to find you because I've never spoken to Dining Diva.
Well, now you did, and Dining Diva is about to go get an Almondina cookie as a snack in the middle of the afternoon.
Not on the recording, it makes a hell of a crunch sound.
No, you, listeners, you can just imagine that that's what's happening next, but we'll do it off microphone.
Maybe I can dip it in that tequila from the people we interviewed earlier.
We are so close, Pittsburgh and Toledo. It's a shame. I can come and visit you one day.
Yeah, you can, yes.
If you're headed this way, let us know.
Would you like to offer some, I don't know what you do, like a competition or something, and somebody can win a case of Almondina?
You make an offer and we'll make it happen. All they have to do is email us at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
Yes.
So, listeners, if you'd like some Almondina cookies, be sure to get your email in. We'll make sure that the first one in wins, and Yovo will be in touch if that happens.
That'll be wonderful.
Okay.
And don't forget the mission of this of Almondina, of our company, it's to put a delicious, healthful cookie on every American table.
That's a noble vision. And thank you so much, you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Peter. You are a delight.
Me too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are about to discuss absolutely my most favorite confection of all times, which is a special brittle made by, we're going to be talking to actually, Brent Madsen.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I have a question, not having grown up with brittle. Is brittle always almost always peanut brittle?
It used to always be, except I've had it with other nuts, lots of them.
Okay, but in the case of Annette's, Brett's peanut butter brittle, it's all peanut butter brittle.
No, he actually has some different nuts.
Does he? Okay, all right. So I wasn't sure. I've been eating them, and I noticed that most of them. See, I had some of the Chardonnay the other day.
Oh dear!
Which is really excellent and very different than the beer brittles.
Uh-huh.
But then the way they got into the business. We're talking to Brett this time. We talked to his sister Annette before. The way they got into this business is really quite amazing. It's a fascinating story. And a lovely sweet product for those of a sweet tooth and even those who don't.
Brent Madsen's been my hero for a long time since I first encountered his product. The company is Annette's Chocolate Factory. But basically, or is Annette's Chocolates. Is it a factory too? Yes, Annette's
Chocolate Factory.
And Annette is your sister.
Yes.
And most of my correspondence is with Mary, who's your wife.
Right.
And you say that you've been in this business for going on 21 years?
Yeah, I know. It's gone by quickly. It's been fun. But yeah, 21 years.
Well, okay, so you started with the chocolate company. Let's go way back to the beginning.
Okay.
And then we'll home in on my favorite thing in the world, which is your brittle. But anyhow. Okay, so you were like 22 or something when you started this. How did you get in?
I was in Denmark. I was working as a carpenter for a year. And when it becomes winter over there, it gets really cold. And my sister Annette said that she wanted to start. She was going to buy an old candy store that was in downtown Napa and had been here for maybe 40 years. The name was Park Tricks. So, and she said, would you like to come help? I said, you know, it's getting cold here. I would love to help. So I came over and helped with the process of starting it up and everything. And about 4 months, 5 months into it, we just became 50-50 partners. And it's been fun ever since.
But you're actually the candy maker.
I am the candy maker. I learned we had a candy maker that was here. He had worked here for 30 of those 40 years from the last company. And he taught me everything I knew. And he was a nice guy. He has certain ways things had to be done, which was kind of a nice way to learn from. And then I was able to branch out and try different things. He probably would disagree with some of the latest things I've made because he was old school. He didn't want to try new things.
Well, now, hold up just a second. Now, so you, your sister, and then you as her partner took over a candy company that already existed?
Yes.
Okay, but you have to have had something in your background that contributed to this absolutely amazing creativity with this candy.
Well, again, I don't know. Growing up, I've always loved candy. And we had a store up the street, and I remember I would spend all my money just buying candy at the store up the street. I just love candy. So when the opportunity came to be able to work in chocolate, it was just really intriguing. I was a landscape architect major in college, horticulture major, and so I guess I'm using it with the cocoa bean part, but I'm not growing anything.
And just you really, having worked Denmark, that new Nordic cuisine is cutting edge now. Have you been to Noma?
Yeah, they have lots of interesting foods there. And that's part of why I like to mix things together that don't really work together maybe sometimes, but then work at the end. Because being in Europe for a long time, they just mixing different flavor profiles together.
Right, yeah. Now, I have the cookbook, but I'm not about to scrape moss off my trees.
This is not your cookbook. This is Noma's cookbook.
Right. But anyhow, Brent, so you started with chocolate, which is a hard enough discipline. I mean, it can be very difficult and tricky to do.
Yeah, it can.
Was it straight chocolate in the beginning, or were there unusual flavors in that, too?
There was really nothing unusual in the beginning. It was very old school. It was very high quality, but old school in how it was made. They didn't make any truffles. They made creams and some caramels. They made about 10 to 12 different kinds of caramels, chocolate caramel, chocolate walnut caramel, Brazil caramel, many different caramels. And over the years, they weren't as popular as they used to be back in the 50s and 60s, I think. But they can, and so we kind of dropped some of those items that didn't work as well, and we replaced them with new creativity.
You're talking like Whitman samplers and things like that.
Yeah, but higher quality. But yes, a lot of the kinds of things that you could get at Sees and places like that. Yeah,
okay,
but we didn't
Sees.
Want to be compared to them anymore.
Okay, so you went along for how many years just doing chocolates?
We went along for probably 5 years just doing the chocolates, and I was learning. And then we came out with our chocolate wine liqueur sauces, and those did really well. Those kept us very busy. And we did that for probably another, 5 years, and about 8 to 10 years ago, somewhere in there, we came up making, experimenting with more brittles. And recently we've changed our candy line and brought a lot of new things into that.
Okay, tell me some of the new things in your candy line.
We've come up with a Hawaiian caramel it has a little salted Hawaiian caramel. It has two macadamia nuts on top, and a little bit of caramel in milk chocolate, and that one's really popular. We've made some different medallions. We call them medallions. They're little round discs of dark chocolate with some nuts and dried fruit on top.
Yeah, I'm looking at the pictures of them.
Right.
It looks like the chocolate is really well tempered and prepared, very shiny.
We work very hard on that. Yeah, that chocolate can be a little tricky at times.
Yeah, I know. I did a chef's cookbook, and I had a terrible time grasping tempering.
Yeah. Well, we have an enrober, chocolate enrober, and it takes about 40 minutes for the chocolate to come from the beginning to the end, and that is, you don't know if you made a mistake in the tempering until they come out at the end.
Oh. So you do have a lot of sophisticated equipment in your factory.
So everything is handmade, no preservatives, no artificial flavors, and it do have a couple pieces of equipment to help make things like coating the chocolate, but everything else is kind of handmade, hand-formed, and stuff like that.
Well, now, okay, so you started playing with brittle.
Yes.
But how do you get from playing with brittle to a Chardonnay brittle and a fiery beer brittle?
We made for years, we made a peanut brittle. A lot of, old-time candy stores always made peanut brittle, and we made a really good peanut brittle. Everyone loved it. And a brewery once came to us and said, we'd like to make something with beer. And so we said, well, maybe we could, make a beer brittle. So we made a beer brittle with their beer in it. And they weren't a fan of it, which was great, because we really liked it, and we carried it on for ourselves, and it's been incredibly well-received and very popular. And then from there, we made a fiery brittle to make it spicy, and kind of, there's a lot of Latin influence in California, and you have a lot of spicy food, so we figured, let's spice it up. So then after the fiery beer brittle, we came out with the Chardonnay beer brittle, because the wineries had a harder time selling the beer brittle, because it didn't do with wine. So it was just a natural flow for the first three.
Well, now you won the Gold Sophie, biggest award they gave at the Fancy Food Show. Best snack, is it?
Best snack food, yes.
And it's divine, absolutely divine.
Thank you.
And it's really unusual. It's chili, lime, tequila, tortilla brittle. How did you come up with that?
It's one of those things that evolved. I love tortilla chips. You know, I'm not a big potato chip fan, but I really like tortilla chips. And I was trying to, you know, what can we make that's truly unique? And I figured, well, I could put tortilla chips in the griddle. But then what do I do from that? And we always, everything we make tends to have an alcohol in it. We have the beer brittle. We have a Kentucky bourbon triple nut beer brittle. It always has some kind of alcohol in it. So,
and that was discovered as one of the big trends of this fancy food show this year, and you've been doing it for years.
Yeah, we've been doing that for close to probably 15 years now.
Yeah.
Especially with our wine truffles. We've been making those for the whole time we've been in business. And so we the tequila in for the alcohol, and then it just made sense that it needed some kind of spice and seasoning on the top, so we have a little bit of chili darble, not enough to really heat your mouth, but enough to detect in there. And then we have the dehydrated lime juice that we put on top that gives a really nice lime flavor.
Have you discovered finger limes yet?
How we discovered what? Well, the finger limes. You know, I heard that is definitely a new trend.
Yes.
Yeah.
You should try them. They're really fun. They have the texture of like caviar, and sort of the citrus pops in your mouth.
Oh yeah, I bet that would be good. I love
and
the citrus.
Did you see Cho or is it Chow Chocolate had a bar with potato chips in it? The chocolate.
Those are interesting. I like
so
those.
So much going on in the world of candy. And
there is mixing everything together.
Right.
Now, what's next from and it's chocolate?
A couple new brittles I have on my mind. I can't exactly say what they are, but there are a couple new brittles that we have. But we're going to wait till probably next year before we bring those out to give a little time for this latest win, and then roll out another one in the future.
Well, now let's do the most important thing, which is
how can
people get some?
Well, they can order online at it's annettes.com. It's A-N-E-T-T-E-S. com.
One N. Everybody remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're saying an email, it's really important for the one N. But on the website, we have both because everyone likes to type two N.
Okay.
And they can get a hold of us there, and they can also call us here at our store in Napa.
Where are you in Napa?
We are right downtown Napa. We have two locations. There's a new Oxbow Market, which is really cool. It does most everything in the Oxbow Market is organic and natural. And
that's off sort of on the edge of town, isn't it?
It's right on the edge of town. And we have a little, I don't know, maybe it's 100 square feet or 60 square foot little booth that's there that we bring chocolate to and supplies to probably four times a week. And then we have our big factory store, which is about four or five blocks away up the street on First Street also.
So you either go to the shops, or you order it online, or you call and order it.
Right, and there are some places we wholesale to in different places. You know, we make for Williams Sonoma. We make an incredibly good brittle for them. It's just being put out in their stores very soon. It's a spice pumpkin seed brittle, which is really good. It's very tender. It has a very nice spice on the outside.
Well, another thing we noticed that's coming in as a flavor is black walnuts.
Black walnuts. Yeah, those black walnuts are good. They give a nice flavor to candies.
I never liked them, but I've decided I like them now.
Well, if you need to get in touch with somebody at the country's biggest black walnut supplier, let us know. We'll put you in contact.
Okay.
He's kind of hard to find because he's in Missouri.
Okay.
which is the black walnut capital of the universe,
yeah.
Turns out.
Isn't that amazing? It's
wow.
A Native American, probably the only Native American nut tree, isn't it? Anyhow, well, I'd love to sit inside your head and find out how you evolve all these into all these recipes because they're just so creative.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun here. I know I bring up some ideas. Some of the people here are like, I don't know about that one, but they turn out. I don't think anyone was really thinking about, well, I don't know if the lime juice is really going to be good on a brittle, but I was determined that it would. Then the stark difference would work, and it did work.
Well, you know, try one for me. I've always wanted to combine green peppercorns with chocolate, dark chocolate.
Yeah, you know, we made a brittle once with peppercorn, and that one turned out, that one was interesting, but it was a little bit...
Too much.
too much pepper, yeah. But it was good.
Well, I just can't wait till your next one comes out. And it's, you know, very addictive is the one problem I find. You start eating it, you can't stop.
Well, thank you.
must be time to go get some now.
Well, Brent, it was fun meeting you at the Fancy Food Show and seeing that and Mary. And talking to you is wonderful as always.
Well,
keep up the good work.
it's fun running a family business when everyone's involved. You're all interested in making a really good product, and you're all equally at stake to to make everything really good. So.
It's the American way. Well done.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Brent.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So there you have it, listeners. It's On the Menu show for another week. If you're going to the Save a Pittsburgh event on the South Side on September 1st here in Pittsburgh, be sure to let us know or come over and say hi. You'll see us sitting at the judges' table, if nowhere else. And we will look forward to seeing you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.